looted. He turned to Sabara. That means the imposters came ready to kill. Perhaps Oni is here to stop the cryo jar delivery. Maybe, Sabara replied. Or maybe they're covering their tracks. It's hard to know which. No, not so difficult, Orsoon said. Tabor, tell us when the firing ends. It's over now, Tabor said. No, wait. I'm hearing double taps, still barely audible. Orsoon caught Castor's attention. They are making certain there are no survivors, he said. They are covering their tracks. Castor was unsurprised. Oni's treachery was as boundless as the stars, and he could easily see them executing a team whom they had hired to perform a task. Speaking over the battle-net, Castor said, Tabor, you have done well. Fall back and hide. When the infidels... The command was interrupted by a wet gasp. A heartbeat later, the battle-net filled with the unmistakable gurgle of someone drowning in his own blood, and the transmission ended in the pop of a deactivating comm unit. Of course, an Oni hit team would have set an overwatch, and the officer pacing in front of the utility skiff. Had he been a fool? Or bait? Tabor, report status. When no reply came, Castor looked to Orsoon. Who were the spies with Neola and Vancus? Orsoon said. He was speaking over the battle-net. Report! There was no response. Ponya? Orsoon's tone was worried. Report! Again, no reply. The pacing officer had been no fool, and Ponya had no doubt paid with her life for Castor's mistake. Castor deactivated his comm and turned to his companions. Shut off your communications, he ordered. Our battle-net has been compromised. As the keepers obeyed, he studied the security station display cluster. The True Light's external cameras offered spherical coverage of the surrounding area, and he could see that there was no one approaching the vessel. But the berthing bay was not a great deal larger than the freighter itself, and beyond it were dozens of partitions and tethered equipment nets that could hide an enemy. Dokab, Orsoon said. We await your command. If the infidels know we are watching, they will move quickly, Castor finished. Castor turned toward the boarding ramp. Now that he knew that it had been Oni who framed the keepers for the Tua murders, the wise thing would have been to withdraw and develop a plan for taking vengeance. But he doubted Oni would give him, or his fellow Dokabs, time. They had dealt the keepers a terrible blow by destroying Salvation Base, and they would move swiftly to exploit their victory. And then, there were the cryo jars to consider. Whatever their true importance, the Sabara woman was willing to sacrifice her freedom to keep them away from Oni. And that argued for quick action. Lead the way, Orsoon, Castor said. We will meet the infidels as they return to their shuttle. Orsoon bowed his head. I am graced by your trust, Dokab. The second in command tapped the control pad, and the ramp descended. He activated a thruster and drifted out through the portal. And then the air was torn by the roar of a rocket-propelled grenade. Incoming! Orsoon roared. The detonation hurled him back across the boarding vestibule into the security station, and the last Castor saw of his old friend was a spray of flame erupting through the backplate of his armor.
Chapter 21 0327 hours, December 16th, 2553, Military Calendar. Storage Area 20, Fabrication Ring Delta, Pinnacle Station, Moon Meridian, Planet Hestia 5, Hestia System. The first M-19 surface-to-surface missile struck the Jirohanai in his chest armor and drove him back through the True Light's boarding portal. The charge detonated inside the vestibule, and Auriel watched through the wide-angle lens of a Papa 10 headset-mounted camera as the target's torso flew apart. Flames covered the security station behind him, and clouds of blood and smoke filled the vessel interior. It always troubled Auriel to dispose of reliable assets. But her generator aspect, the Archeon-class Ancilla Intrepid Eye, had been clear. Castor had reached the end of his service life, his capture of the Dark Moon operatives in the Contemplarium, and his relentless pursuit of their hidden masters had rendered the Dokkab an untenable liability. His entire cell was to be eliminated at the first opportunity, before he learned any more about Dark Moon Enterprises, and placed Intrepid Eye herself at risk. For 1,000 system ticks, Auriel continued to watch through the headset camera, and waited. She caught glimpses of shredded flesh and blood-spattered armor. Displays shattered, bodies fell, smoke billowed out over the boarding ramp, and still nothing. Lieutenant Bartolin Cradock did not fire the second missile. Lieutenant Cradock. Auriel was transmitting directly into Cradock's earbud from the Pinnacle Station utility skiff, where she had taken residence in the craft's master control system. Is there a reason for the delay? Please fire the second missile now. At what? Cradock was currently in Storage Area 20, adjacent to the berthing bay where the True Light was tethered, clinging to a cargo net full of laser welder gas cartridges. With his free hand, he was holding on to the trigger housing of a shoulder-firing M41 Spanker missile launcher. I can't see a target. Fire it into the boarding vestibule. Auriel was careful to keep an even tone. Intrepid Eye had realized that Cradock would be unreliable under pressure, and Auriel had sent him into combat only because Papa 10's other team members were busy with the cryojar recovery. It is important to keep the survivors disoriented. We need to delay them for another 42 seconds. Survivors? Cradog's gaze was fixed on the smoke pouring out of the transport's boarding hatch, and he made no move to aim the M41 Spanker. Are you crazy? We'll be lucky if that freighter doesn't blow now. If I hit it again, it could take out the entire station. As Cradock spoke, a massive silhouette appeared in the smoke, just inside the True Light's boarding portal, then floated through the hatchway into the berthing bay. Cradock gasped in disbelief, then released the cargo net and raised the M41 Spanker to fire. Unaccustomed to maneuvering in zero-G, he sent himself spinning, and Auriel watched through his headset as the missile went wide of the True Light's boarding portal and struck 12 meters aft. The silhouette emerged from the smoke and resolved itself into a Jirohanai clad in power armor. He raised a Type 25 spike rifle and opened fire into the storage area toward Cradock, who left the Spanker to float free and lunged for the cargo net with both hands. The maneuver sent Cradog's feet tumbling over his head, and Auriel had to activate an image stabilizing routine. The spinning blur resolved into a gleaming spray of spikes, coming from a Jirohanai with a burn-blistered face. His expression was so contorted with rage and loss that Auriel required 7 system ticks to recognize him as Castor. His long gray beard was matted with blood and tiny bits of charred flesh, and behind him followed 3 more Jirohanai, all wearing blue shockplate armor with gold trim. Cradock caught hold of the cargo net and began to pull hand over hand, trying to reach cover. Only 5 seconds had passed since Auriel had ordered him to fire the second missile, so she knew that Castor and his companions would have ample time to prevent the Papa 10 recovery squad from returning the cryojars to the utility skiff. Cradock screamed and whipped his head around, and Auriel's view of the departing Jirohanai was replaced by globules of blood, rising through a gash in the lieutenant's pant leg. She tried to keep Castor and his warriors in view by analyzing the distorted images around the rim of the headset's fisheye lens, but her line of sight was blocked by the contents of the cargo net. Auriel opened a channel to all of Papa Ten. "Lieutenant Cradog's attack was only a partial success," she transmitted. "You should expect to be engaged by 4 armored Jirohanai." "Brutes," said Boo Sedanik, one of the team's 3 female operatives. "Those cryo jars better not be vital to humanity or anything. Can the chatter." The order came from the Papa Ten commander, a square-faced Oni officer named Porter Sahir. "Appreciate the warning." "I am glad to be of service," Auriel replied. "Lieutenant Cradog will provide support."
"Support?" Cradog replied, gasping. "I'm wounded."
"It is only a flesh wound." Auriel could tell by the elongated gash in Cradog's pant material that the spike had grazed his calf without embedding itself. "You are quite capable of fighting, especially in a weightless environment."
"I'm in pain."
"Lieutenant Cradog, we need any assistance you can provide." Sahir's tone bordered on the derisive. Clearly he was not expecting much from Cradog. "4 brutes in shockplate armor are a lot to handle, even for us."
"I'll try," Cradog said, fighting for breath. "But I'm not sure what I can do."
"Perhaps you should retrieve the M41 Spanker," Auriel calmly suggested, "and reload it." As Auriel spoke, she was tapping into Sahir's headset camera so she could observe the Papa Ten preparations. The commander had stopped his team about 30 meters from the Liang Dortmund cargo transport, where the dark moon Turaco had been concealed. And as he issued assignments, his camera shifted from one operative to the next. They were all grim-faced soldiers with steady gazes and confident postures. The men had heavy brows and square jaws, while the women had small noses and taut features. There were more brown eyes than blue. Zedanik's eyes were green, her complexion tawny brown. Oracle could see that the execution of the Dark Moon couriers had left everyone's coveralls flecked with tiny droplets of blood. But the stains were causing less alarm among the spectators than the M7 SMGs and M45E short-barrel shotguns being drawn from the Papa Ten equipment satchels. Construction workers were now fleeing on all sides, clunk running down mag lanes or floating into nearby berthing bays, using cargo nets and tether straps to pull themselves behind cover. There was no sign of a security response, though Auriel expected that would soon change. She was monitoring all of Pinnacle Station's security channels and knew that Administrator Sloan, the station's AI superintendent, was assembling a force up to the task. Sahir deployed Papa Ten's forward element in an L formation designed to catch the enemy in a crossfire kill zone. He led this element himself, leaving Boo Zedanik in charge of a 3-person detail that would follow with the cryo jars. Back in Storage Area 20, Cradog was returning to the cargo net with his errant M41 Spanker. He failed to activate his braking thrusters in time and hit hard. The entire load shifted, but he managed to hook a boot through the mesh before the tether reached full extension and rebounded. He flailed around and barely kept himself from flying off, then finally began to fumble with the weapon, trying to find the barrel release so he could insert the reload barrels he wore slung across his back. The boom of a shotgun sounded over the Papa Ten communications channel. Then a Jirohanai tumbled into Sahir's field of vision. The brute's maneuvering thrusters were still firing, and blood globules were flying from his head in a wild helix. It took only 100 system ticks, 1/10 of a human second, for the channel to erupt into screams and small arms fire. A steady flow of casualties tumbled into view, all human. Most appeared to be construction workers hit in the crossfire, but at least 3 were Papa Ten operatives still wearing their headsets. Realizing Papa Ten would never fight its way past the Jirohanai without help, Auriel checked on Cradog's progress. He had finally found the release catch and removed the Spanker's expended barrels, but his headset camera was panning about wildly as he tried to pull the reload barrels off his back without letting the weapon drift away. By the time he could reassemble the weapon and move into position to use it, assuming he ever managed that, the battle would be over. Oriel scanned the cameras of the surviving members of Papa Ten's forward element squad and glimpsed an incoming Mauler blast. Then only Sahir's feed remained. He had 3 Jirohanai soaring toward him, all firing weapons while still expertly maneuvering. Sahir's own response from an M7 SMG was, for the most part, simply ricocheting off his attacker's armor, though one brute had taken a hit to the face and was missing part of his jaw. Oriel consulted a station schematic and saw there was no longer any way for Zedanik's squad to reach the utility skiff with the cryo jars. She considered trying to contact Castor and demand that he stand down, but the consequences were dire. Even if she were able to command his attention in the middle of a firefight, she would risk revealing her connection to Dark Moon. Castor would feel used and betrayed, and he was 3.72 times more likely to lose faith in the Great Journey than to accept her deception as a test of devotion. And if Castor lost faith, his Jirohanai pride would demand revenge. There was no predicting what he might do. He might undertake a relentless war against Dark Moon's Oni Masters, or he might see through intrepid eyes layers of deception and see that Oni was as much a victim as he had been. The only thing Oriel knew with certainty was that a vengeful Castor would be a dangerous Castor, which meant that Intrepid Eye was correct. The time had come to stop taking chances and eliminate him. Petty Officer Zedanik, please take your squad and the cryojars and board a personnel shuttle. Oriel transmitted the order across the entire Papa Ten comm channel, so that any survivors would understand her plan. Proceed to Meridian surface and remain concealed until reinforcements arrive.
No way, Zedanik replied. We're not leaving without Papa Leader. Do it, Sahir was yelling, but even so, his voice was nearly inaudible over a long burst of automatic fire. That's an order, Boo!
There was a half-second pause before Zedanik replied,
Affirmative, lead. And thank you.
If Sahir replied, his answer was lost to the roar of a Mauler blast tearing through his concealed body armor. Oriel switched to Zedanik's headset camera and found her soaring down a concourse toward the shuttle station at the core of Fabrication Ring Delta. Ahead of her, panicked construction workers were hurling themselves off both sides of the mag lane. Another burst of gunfire sounded behind Zedanik, and her camera panned around behind her. The other 2 members of her squad were coming down the concourse on their backs. Each man was clutching a cryo jar to his chest with one arm and operating an M7 SMG with the other. The combat stabilization feature of their thruster harnesses was having trouble compensating for the sustained fire, so they were weaving and bobbing wildly. Sahir's corpse was still floating in the concourse entrance. It was a contorted, spider-like figure surrounded by a halo of blood globules. And moving past it were 4 Jirohanai warriors. Petty Officer Zedanik, Oriel said, your squad must board the next shuttle. I will see to the rest.
You'd better, Zedanik replied. We're running low on ammo.
Her headset camera turned forward again. And 5 paces ahead, Oriel saw the grime-streaked throat of the shuttle's boarding tube. At the far end of the tube, inside the craft itself, a cluster of alarmed construction workers sat strapped into their acceleration chairs. Their eyes were wide and their faces pale. Have faith, Petty Officer Zedanik, Oriel said. You cannot imagine the extent of my capabilities. Oriel used a Pinnacle Station security channel to access a schematic of the shuttle. A wedge-shaped model with an ultra-wide cabin. It was a short-hop vessel designed to transport large numbers of personnel to and from Meridian's surface with a minimum of maintenance. Although it was usually flown automatically by an onboard AI, during an emergency, a passenger could assume limited control. There is a pilot's compartment at the front of the cabin. Oriel was transmitting only to Zedanique and her two squad members now. Once you're aboard, open it and activate the emergency override. That will allow you to seal the craft and leave the station.
Then what?
Zedanique was already floating down the shuttle's boarding tube.
Could we rendezvous with a fast gus?
Negative, Oriel said. Your control will be limited. The shuttle will descend to Meridian's surface automatically. You will be taken to an emergency landing zone a safe distance from the settlement. Once you are on the surface, you will then be able to open the hatches.
Thanks. I guess.
Zedanique entered the shuttle's passenger cabin and turned toward the pilot's cabin.
Papa Ten out.
Oriel continued to monitor the situation aboard the shuttle. After the rest of Zedanique's squad boarded, the petty officer used the emergency override to seal the hatches. Papa Ten's pursuers were only halfway down the concourse when the shuttle launched. In Storage Bay 20, Cradog had finally inserted the reload barrels into the M41 spanker and was just locking the release catch. His leg was still bleeding, and the air around him was filled with crimson globules.
Lieutenant Cradog, Oriel said, perhaps you should return to the utility skiff and tend to your wound. What about Papa Ten? Cradog asked. I thought they needed support.
It is too late for that. Oriel detected a scratch in the signal and realized that someone, probably Pinnacle Station security, was attempting to eavesdrop on the Papa Ten comnet. She switched to a sequestered channel, then changed the encryption and continued to address Cradog. Your support has proven quite useless. Cradog's tone grew indignant.
Well, I'm a scientist, not a soldier.
There is no need to be defensive, Oriel said. It is my fault. Intrepid Eye warned me you would not perform well under pressure. Cradog looked toward the shuttle stations.
So you're just going to abandon the cryojars? He demanded.
I thought Intrepid Eye needed them to develop the vaccine. I thought the vaccine was the only way to protect humanity from an Asteroidea outbreak.
That is correct. It would have been more precise to say that the vaccine would control the coming outbreak. But Oreo was not sure how much Cradog knew about the long-term plans of her prime aspect. Given his flaws, it seemed unlikely that Intrepid Eye would consider his genetic line worthy of the mantle of responsibility. When the culling began, Cradog's descendants would not be among those who received an inoculation.
I will recover the cryojars, Lieutenant Cradog, Oriel continued.
The best way for you to help now is to return to the utility skiff and leave the M41 spanker behind. It would be an unnecessary complication for Pinnacle Station security to find it in your possession.
Cradog immediately pushed the spanker aside and began to thruster his way back toward the skiff's berthing bay.
Oriel concentrated her attention on the Pinnacle Station security feeds and quickly realized that Jiral Hanai had not given up their pursuit of the cryojars. Dozens of reports placed them at the Fabrication Ring's shuttle station, awaiting the arrival of the next craft. Recalling the interference she had felt in the Papa Ten communications channel, Oriel reopened the channel and said, I need to speak to Administrator Sloan. Now. The scratch grew fainter, and for 300 system ticks, Oriel awaited reply. When none came, she said, it is no use hiding. My counter-surveillance routines are impregnable, and if you compel me to force my way into your system, I will not be gentle. The interference modulated itself into an input signal, and the image of a powerfully built man with a bald head and rugged features appeared on the communications holograph in the utility skiff's cockpit. The pilot, an Oni contract asset whose primary employment was with Pinnacle Station, let out a startled gasp and reached for the controls. Oriel quickly internalized the image and diverted control of the holograph to herself, then addressed the newcomer digitally.
Administrator Sloan,
I require you to stop all further shuttle departures from Fabrication Ring Delta.
And why would I do that? Sloane demanded.
Because the next shuttle is loading. Auriel paused to check the Pinnacle Station surveillance feeds. The loading tube doors were already sliding open.
Now.
Good riddance, Sloane replied. His voice was deep and stormy. Down there, your friends and the Jirohanae can fight all they like. It will damage nothing that matters.
Then you know where they will land.
I know the emergency landing site is 10 kilometers from the nearest settlement, Sloane said. That is the only important thing. Auriel understood. Meridian was a former mining colony and arms production center, whose surface had been glassed during the Human Covenant War, and reclamation efforts were just getting underway. As long as the battle between Zedanik's squad and the Jirohanae occurred in the unreclaimed wastelands, any damage it caused would be of no concern to Administrator Sloane, or his superiors at Liang Dortmund.
What of the damage you have caused by failing to provide a secure handover environment? Auriel asked. That is a violation of your contract with Dark Moon. Is that important?
Sloane flared red with a signal surge.
How do you know the terms of my contract with Dark Moon?
Come, Administrator Sloane, Auriel said. Pinnacle Station sent a skiff to meet our prowler. You understand how we know the terms.
Only spies, Sloane growled. They're everywhere.
It was the expected answer, of course. Intrepid Eye was using Oni as a cover for the entire Asteroidea project, and a human AI had not been created that could penetrate her misattribution protocols.
Naturally, I cannot confirm your suspicions, Auriel said.
Sloane's image grew even brighter.
It makes no difference. The Dark Moon operatives are dead, and Pinnacle Station has no arrangements with Oni.
Not directly. Sloane hesitated, allowing 500 system ticks to pass, then asked,
Are you saying Dark Moon is an Oni cover company?
Not at all. Auriel could not allow Sloane to make this particular assumption. Dark Moon Enterprises was, in fact, unaffiliated with Oni. It was being run by another of Intrepid Eye's minor aspects. One that was unknown even to Auriel, and it had relationships with several clients who would break off contact if rumors started to circulate that Dark Moon was an Oni front. But we do subcontract with private firms on occasion.
With Dark Moon?
Sloane tipped his holographic head back and emitted a deep laugh.
A cover company, I would believe. That kind of doublethink would be just like Perengoski. But a contract between Oni and Dark Moon? The bad blood between them is the worst kept secret in the Orion Arm.
Then you might be wise to remember that, Auriel said. The Pinnacle Station surveillance feeds showed the last of the Jirohanae floating down the boarding tube.
Obviously, we know you have been helping Dark Moon. And Oni has a long memory.
Sloane's image rippled. He remained silent for 1,000 system ticks, a full second, then asked,
Why should Pinnacle Station help Oni? All you have done is shoot up our people and damage our equipment.
You do not wish the gratitude of the United Nations Space Command?
Sure, Sloane said. As long as it comes with compensation.
I am not certain I understand. Auriel had no objection to paying Sloane, as long as he did the job. But she could not imagine what kind of compensation an AI would want.
Are you asking for a bribe?
Insulting me is no way to win my cooperation, Sloane said. As he spoke, an alarm sounded from the central shuttle station,
and the craft the Jirohanai had boarded dropped away from the docks and began its descent toward Meridian's surface. But I do expect Leung Dortmund to be paid for the damage Pinnacle Station has taken. And I want to be rewarded for my own risk. And then you will help us recover our cryo jars. You have my word, Sloane said. I'll do everything in my power. Then I need you to destroy the Jirohanai shuttle, Auriel said. They have activated the emergency override, and I have been unable to locate a bypass routine. You haven't heard my price. And whose fault is that? Auriel retorted. Please hurry. Jirohanai are sturdy. It would be best to destroy their shuttle before it enters the atmosphere. Whatever you say, Sloane said. Pinnacle Station has been suffering some overruns, and that little battle isn't going to help. We're going to need an investor. And you wish me to provide one? A big one, Sloane said. The silent kind. That can be arranged. Auriel did not even need to consider the request. Intrepid Eye had access to a vast network of resources, so it would be a small matter to establish a holding company capable of supplying the funds Sloane required. Auriel initiated the articles of incorporation and queued them for transmission. The proposal will be relayed via the Fast Gus as soon as our skiff departs Pinnacle Station. I am sure you saw the details. 20 million credits is less than I was thinking. Oni will not be providing the funds, Auriel said. It will be an associated entity. There are limits to what I can promise on its behalf. But this entity will make another investment each month. Indeed, Auriel said. Eld Ventures will continue to invest for as long as you continue to cooperate. And if my cooperation ends... That would be a mistake, Administrator. Auriel prepared a minor compulsion routine and launched it behind a subdued threat. The tactic was something of a risk, given that he was a fully operational smart AI, and she was only a minor aspect of an Archeon-class Ancilla. But if it succeeded, it would guarantee Sloane's cooperation with Intrepid Eye for a long time to come. The director of Eld Ventures is not prone to forgiveness. Sloane hesitated, then said, Understood. When he looked away, Auriel knew her attack had succeeded. She reinforced her victory by asking, Then we are in agreement. Sloane nodded and said, There is only the matter of my own reward. The shuttle is entering the atmosphere, Auriel urged. Once the ionization blackout begins, it will be too late to transmit. You will be unable to take control of the shuttle. I have only a simple request, Sloane replied. Information. Of course, that would be what an AI valued most. Hurry. Tell me what the cryo jars contain. Human organs. Ionization static began to cloud the transmission from the Jirohanai shuttle. Auriel decided to avoid further delay and added, The tissue is required to make a vaccine that will benefit all humanity. Sloane's image clouded. What Oni does never benefits all humanity. In this case, it will, Auriel insisted. Now I have kept my part of our bargain. Please keep yours and destroy the Jirohanai shuttle. I would if I could. What does that mean? It means I can't, Sloane said. There is no emergency override bypass routine. You lied to me. Auriel began to dump heat as her analytic routines raced into action, searching for the error in their earlier interactions and a way to patch it. You should re-examine your construction schedule.
I suspect Eld Ventures is about to show an interest in your supply chain. Your vendors could develop delivery problems. I didn't lie. You assumed, Sloane said, and I never promised to stop the Jirohana. I said I'd do everything in my power to help you recover your cryojars, which I will, if we still have a deal. And what exactly is in your power? Auriel asked. You will not deceive me again, Administrator. Attempting to do so will affect how Eld Ventures views a potential investment. Given what just happened here, the director might even conclude that Pinnacle Station should be recommended for placement on the UNSC's suspicious ports list. All traffic arriving or departing would be inspected. I know what the SP list is, Sloane said. I can give you the shuttle landing zone, and I can point out a pretty good extraction point. But that's all I can do. Everything else is on you and your team. Okay. Auriel took 250 system ticks to review their prior negotiations and confirm that Sloane was correct about them, that he had avoided promising to stop the Jirohanae, and realized that he was being careful to stay within those same parameters now. Perhaps he was offering all the assistance he could. Pinnacle Station, after all, was a civilian construction site, not a military compound. Accept it, Auriel said at last. Provide the locations, and you shall have your investor. My silent investor. Of course, Administrator Sloane, Auriel said. As long as you cooperate, Eld Ventures is always silent.
Chapter 22 0349 hours, December 16th, 2553, Military Calendar. Loading Dock 20, Fabrication Ring Delta, Pinnacle Station. Moon Meridian. Planet Hestia 5, Hestia System. The true light boarding vestibule stank of charred flesh and horrid carnage, and most of the dead were unidentifiable beyond their species. Several blackened bodies had beaks, suggesting they were Kigyar, and the ripped armor floating in front of the wrecked security station had clearly contained a Jirohanae before being blown apart. But there was no odor of decay, and the blood globules drifting through the air were congealed, not dry. Veda Lopez estimated that the time of attack had been anywhere from 10 to 30 minutes earlier. The only human body belonged to a female of approximately 50. The woman had been hurled against a hatch jam so hard her torso had folded backward. Now, she hung in the hatchway with her dented skull cocked over one shoulder, her broken arms floating limply at her sides, her legs bent upward at the knees. She had suffered only a few second-degree burns, none that had raised a blister larger than a thumbnail, and Veda thought that, miraculously, her chest might be moving. Veda signaled Olivia, the only ferret accompanying her on the initial reconnaissance, to keep watch in the vestibule. Like Veda herself, Olivia wore a fluorescent green jumpsuit with Pinnacle Station Visitor printed across the chest and shoulders. Up her sleeve, she carried a silenced M6P pocket pistol sufficient to handle any unexpected threats from deeper in the transport. Veda carried an identical version inside her jumpsuit. Veda used her thruster harness to maneuver over to the woman. A security card floated from a lanyard around her neck. Director Agnes Sabara, New Leaf, Yosavi Field Laboratory. Veda touched her fingertips to Sabara's throat and felt a thready pulse. She pulled up both eyelids and found two huge fixed pupils. Agnes. Dr. Sabara. Veda released one eyelid and watched it slide closed, then continued to watch the open eye as she slapped Sabara's cheek. The pupil showed no reaction. Agnes, can you hear me? I doubt it, Olivia said, and even if she can, you're not doing her any favors waking her up.
Didn't you see that gray stuff in there?
Veda glanced through the hatchway and, in the next cabin, saw a thumb-sized worm of gray matter floating among the blood globules.
Damn. We could have used a witness.
Veda's disappointment ran deeper than that, of course. Another Gao citizen had gotten caught in one of Arlo Casile's schemes, and this woman would be lucky if it cost her nothing but her life. Veda couldn't help wondering how much trouble she herself would have been in now, had she killed Casile during the interrogation in the Yosavi jungle. It had been the one thing that Captain Yuan told her she couldn't do when he allowed her to accompany Blue Team.
But still,
Veda was pretty sure the entire Hispaniola sector would have been better off if she had ignored the order.
So what now? Olivia asked.
She glanced back through the boarding portal, where a guard dressed in the deep red jumpsuit of the Pinnacle Station Security Force hung floating. Armed with a Bandia's Arms low-velocity submachine gun, he wore a ballistic vest and helmet that matched his red jumpsuit.
We don't have a lot of time to figure this out.
Veda nodded.
I know.
To keep a low profile, Veda and Olivia were the only two ferrets looking for the cryo jars aboard Pinnacle Station. Everyone else was back in Berthing Bay 12, waiting aboard the Turaco in full armor, ready to come running at the first hint of trouble. So far, it appeared that would not be necessary. Pinnacle Station security was being oddly accommodating to Veda and Olivia, especially considering their weak cover. The pair were posing as UNSC security inspectors on a surprise construction review. Such reviews were routine for any installation intending to receive commercial vessels registered with the UEG. But usually a whole team of inspectors descended on the facility and demanded to audit everything from material orders to blueprint alterations. Veda and Olivia had simply presented a set of hastily forged credentials to the nearest security officer and, despite seeing death nearly everywhere they looked, they had been granted unfettered access to the entire station. It smacked of desperation. Veda maneuvered past Olivia into the boarding portal, then addressed the security guard outside.
"Excuse me," she said, "but there's a woman still alive in here."
The guard, a broad-faced man with crooked teeth, flashed a broad smile. "Yes, ma'am," he said. "So are a couple of the jackals, but there's nothing to worry about. We've removed all of their weapons." Veda did not bother to hide her astonishment.
"I'm talking about human decency," she said. "These beings are suffering."
The guard's smile vanished. "So are Pinnacle Station's people," he said. "I know you've seen the battle site. You passed through it on the way from the murder scene."
"We did," Veda said, more puzzled than ever.
She and Olivia had located the bodies of the Dark Moon operatives just minutes after floating onto Pinnacle Station, when they noticed a security team swarming around a huge Liang Dortmund cargo transport. Seeing blood spatters on the hull exterior and a couple of bodies in the adjacent storage area being bagged for removal, they had attempted to bluff their way aboard on the strength of their counterfeit credentials. At first, they had been rudely rebuffed, but the guard had unexpectedly waved them back and explained that his supervisor had decided it would be unwise to deny access to a team of UNSC security inspectors. Veda had assumed a smug air and led Olivia through the hatch. Inside, they had found the Dark Moon Turaco floating in the transport's immense cargo hold. The operatives themselves, presumably the same couriers who had been transporting the cryo jars, had all been professionally executed. Their bodies had been left in the passenger cabin, and the cryo jars were nowhere to be seen. Hoping to pick up the trail, Veda and Olivia had left the transport and followed a path of carnage, emergency services personnel and security officers to the True Light's berthing bay, where they had once again been allowed to board with no apparent hesitation. An uneasy chill was starting to run down Veda's spine. When the security guard continued to look at her expectantly, Veda said, "If the medical staff can save any of these victims, one of them might be able to tell you what this mess is all about." The guard's smile returned, this time sly.
Isn't that what you're here for?
Olivia floated forward.
What did you say?
Come on, the guard replied. How dumb do you think we are? A couple of security inspectors just happened to show up 20 minutes after all hell breaks loose? You're Oni, right?
Don't answer that, Otis, Feta said, using the name on Olivia's counterfeit credentials. We're not going to fool this guy.
Yes, ma'am, Olivia said. I can see that. The guard beamed, then clicked off his microphone and spoke more softly. Look, no one in station security knows what the hell is going on here, but it's pretty clear this is serious, and that it's way above our heads.
Possibly, Feta said.
Definitely, the guard said. We're not trained to fight Jirohanai, and we don't have spankers. So if you guys want to clean up your own mess, nobody's going to stand in your way.
I'd still like to save the woman.
Veda spoke in a conspiratorial tone. There are a few things that are unclear even to us, so being able to interrogate her would tell you nothing I cannot. The voice came from inside the guard's helmet, deep and booming and so loud the man's face screwed up in pain. He unbuckled his chin strap and tore the headgear off. The voice continued to speak. I can tell you everything that happened. It began to rumble down the True Light's main access corridor, from the direction of the flight deck. In private. Veda and Olivia exchanged glances. Then Olivia turned to the guard. Give us some room. She dropped her hand, sliding the M6P out of her sleeve into her palm, then added, anyone who boards dies. Clear? The guard's face paled. Got it. Veda reached into her jumpsuit and drew her own M6P, then made sure the thread microphone sewn into her undershirt was exposed. Blue team, be ready.
Always are, came Fred's reply. You be careful.
Too late for that, Feta said. You haven't been a good influence.
I'll try to do better.
I can hear you, the deep voice said, now speaking over team comm, and you're running out of time.
Olivia took the lead, and they advanced up the access corridor to the True Light's flight deck. On the pad of a small holoplinth stood the figure of a bald man with a muscular build and craggy features. His eyes were set deep beneath a heavy brow, and his jaw was firm and narrow.
Your Administrator Sloan, I presume, Feta said. Or should I say Sladwell?
Sloan's image shuddered for an instant, then steadied.
I prefer Sloan, he said, but you've made your point. Oni knows who I was.
We know who you were. Veda recognized leverage when she heard it. Whether that makes it into the files is your choice.
There's no need to push the point. Sloan's booming voice filled the flight deck. I am honoring the arrangement, am I not?
Arrangement? Veda had no idea what he was talking about. But better not to let him know that.
We're happy with your cooperation so far, she said. But Command wasn't expecting this kind of problem. I hope not, Sloan growled. The hit on the Dark Moon couriers was clean, but the Keepers caught your team by surprise.
Our team? Feta asked. Which one?
Sloan remained silent for a moment, then said, Papa Ten.
Veda had never heard of Papa Ten. She glanced to Olivia, who said, Papa is a security designation. Never worked with Ten.
Sloan's eyes seemed to recede deeper beneath his brow, and he studied Veda for a long moment.
You didn't know that.
We're just the relief team, Olivia said quickly. They don't tell us everything.
Sloan's gaze shifted, and his eyes grew visible again.
Typical Oni bullshit, he said. Everything is need to know, right?
That, and crossed signals, Veda said. She had the sense that Sloan was testing them.
We were trailing the Keepers when the relief call came in. Since we were here, we're the relief, Olivia said. So where are the cryojars now? Sloane shifted his attention back to Olivia.
With Papa Ten, he said. The survivors, I mean.
Olivia raised her brow.
The Keepers hit Papa Ten? She asked.
They were after the cryojars?
Olivia was being a little direct in her questioning, and revealing too much about what they didn't know. But right now, that was working in their advantage. Sloane seemed less suspicious of her than of Veda, and Veda was still trying to figure out what Dark Moon was doing on Pinnacle Station in the first place. They had obviously come to deliver the cryojars to someone. But whom?
When Veda did not leap in with another question, Olivia asked, "How many survivors are there?"
"Three Oni," Sloane said. "Four Jirohanai."
Oni. Papa Ten was Oni, and from the sound of it, Papa Ten was the team that had executed the Dark Moon couriers.
Veda did not like where her thoughts were going.
"Something's not making sense to me," she said. "What was Dark Moon doing here in the first place?"
"You are asking me?" Sloane replied. "They paid for a hidden berth. I supplied a hidden berth. If their onboard security was inadequate, that had nothing to do with Pinnacle Station."
"But Papa Ten was the only group that met them?" Olivia asked. "And it left with the cryojars."
"As Oni expected, I am sure," Sloane said. "Is it any wonder half the colonies still want free of your yoke?"
Olivia looked to Veda and said nothing, and Veda knew the young Spartan had come to the same unthinkable conclusion she had. Veda turned back to Sloane.
"Where are the Papa Ten survivors now?"
Sloane smiled.
"Not on Pinnacle Station."
Chapter 23 0354 hours, December 16th, 2553, military calendar. Captured Tarako reconnaissance craft, insertion run. Moon Meridian, planet Hestia 5, Hestia system. If the UNSC Testing and Evaluation Command were ever to request Veda's opinion of the Tarako reconnaissance craft, she would report that it was a tough, versatile little vessel, capable of many different missions. It had served them well during the escape from Salvation Base and the insertion on Gao, and she would gladly use it as a standoff observation platform in any number of hostile environments. But a dropship, it was not. The cramped interior was heating up fast as it plunged into Meridian's atmosphere, and Veda's chair was shuddering so hard she feared the mounting bolts would shear right off. The hull's ovoid shape seemed to enhance the effects of entry blackout, expanding the ionization envelope and degrading even internal communications. Team comm popped and crackled, and the heads-up display inside her custom-modified SPI Armor's Mirage-class helmet flickered badly. She could barely read the interfaces. Most worrisome of all, Veda had a bar of C-12 stowed in one of her cargo belt ammo pouches, and a handful of remote detonators in the compartment next to it. In theory, no amount of static charge would ever activate the detonators. But if theory was wrong, the Tarako would finish its descent in a rain of thumb-sized shards. Fred's voice sounded inside Veda's helmet.
"Inspect Lopez, it's not necessary to join the strike team." His words were so scratchy with ionic interference that Veda had to listen hard to understand them. "You're not a direct action specialist, and this will be a very simple operation."
"Right. Simple operation,"
Veda answered in a light tone, though it was difficult with all the rattling and shaking.
"I've heard that before."
A chorus of chuckles sounded over the static-filled team comm, but Fred remained serious. "Team bio shows your respiration and heart rate elevated."
"No kidding," Veda said.
The entry blackout would prevent their conversation from being relayed to the Silent Joe.
so she felt comfortable speaking freely over TeamCom. Something stinks about Papa 10, and you know it.
So?
Come on, Lieutenant. It was Olivia, barely squeezed into the navigator's chair in her own SPI armor, who said this. It's pretty clear Papa 10 didn't just intercept those cryo jars. They were on Pinnacle Station to take delivery.
So? Fred asked again.
Maybe Osman was working an angle.
Sure, Ash said, snorting. Also wearing his SPI armor, he was sitting at the engineering station, just forward of Olivia.
Or maybe Papa 10 is mixed up with the Tua assassination, and they hit the Dark Moon couriers to cover their tracks.
Which means they might not be all that happy to be relieved, Mark added. He was at the back of the cabin, large enough in his SPI armor that he filled a pair of passenger seats. We should treat them as capture targets.
Not our orders, Fred said.
Yeah.
But is it against orders? Kelly asked.
Like Fred, she was too large in her Mjolnir armor to sit in any of the Tarako's chairs. Instead, she was standing in the aisle behind him, her hands braced against the ceiling as she rocked gently back and forth with the shuddering of the vessel. Fred exhaled into his mic, then turned to face her.
You too?
Lopez is right, Kelly said. Something smells bad here.
I agree, Linda volunteered.
She was in the boarding vestibule, hidden from Veda's view behind the engineering station partition. The order arrived via microburst, yes?
Affirmative.
Fred's tone was wary. Microburst transmissions were notoriously difficult to confirm, either by voice recognition or return transmission. But the authorization code was right. And who else would have access to the encryption?
Why would Captain Ewan break comm silence to issue such an obvious order? Linda countered. Wouldn't you have just assumed you should follow Papa 10 and offer combat support anyway?
More or less. Fred paused, clearly weighing his team's reservations against his apparent orders, then said, "We'll relieve Papa 10. But we'll assume responsibility for the cryo jars ourselves, and let command sort it out later. Everyone clear on that?" He turned his faceplate toward Veda. Knowing he was monitoring her vital signs on Team Bio, Veda thought of calm water, a trick she used to relax in trying circumstances.
"Clear as rain," she said.
"You didn't think I had something else planned, did you?"
"You always have something else planned."
As Fred spoke, the Tarako's nose rose sharply, and the vibrations began to diminish. "But this time, we're doing it by the book." His faceplate remained turned toward Veda.
"Got it," Veda said.
"Secure the cryo jars. Save the papas. Let Osman sort it out later. Okay?" Veda shrugged, then reluctantly nodded. She did not trust Osman all that much, but the Admiral had seemed genuinely outraged by the attack on the Tua family. If the culprits turned out to be a rogue Oni unit, Veda suspected that the justice would be swift. Quiet, but swift. The entry blackout ended, and the tack map on Veda's HUD showed the landing zone less than a kilometer below. A crescent-shaped terrace wrapped around the shoulder of a gentle mountain. The LZ was about 500 meters long and surrounded by barren slopes of lecithiliorite, the hard, vitreous mineral left behind whenever the Covenant glassed a world. Near the center of the zone, a pair of wedge-shaped transport shuttles were resting on their bellies. They were oriented nose to nose with their emergency hatches open, and the tack map showed a cluster of humans gathered inside the shuttle on the left. There were too many to be the Papa 10 squad, and they were in a pretty indefensible position, so Veda assumed they were just construction personnel who had been aboard the shuttle when it was commandeered. A pair of rescue crawlers were advancing up the valley from the settlement at Meridian Station, but they were still 5 kilometers from the mountain's base. By the time they reached the LZ, Fred's recovery team would have the cryo jars and be on the way back to the Silent Joe. There was no sign of combat near the LZ, and Veda saw no fading infrared signatures that might be cooling bodies.
The voice of the pilot, Taj McAvoy, sounded over team comm. Weren't we expecting a hot insertion?
We were, Fred said. There's a band of Jirohanai keepers after a squad of Papa Ten survivors. You should be seeing plenty of fireworks by now.
I'm not seeing anything, McAvoy said. The Turaco was only a few hundred meters above the LZ.